This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the UN Refugee Agency says it is making contingency plans in Nigeria to care for a possible influx of tens of thousands of Anglophone Cameroonian refugees. Unrest is growing in English-speaking parts of Cameroon amid tensions with the French-speaking majority.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, Kenyan opposition Raila Odinga says last week's presidential poll was a sham election that must not be allowed to stand. And the Libyan National Army is investigating the killing of at least 36 men whose bodies were found dumped alongside a road.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga says last week's presidential poll was a sham election that must not be allowed to stand and is urging supporters to exercise their right to dissent. But Odinga did not outline specific legal action in his speech today, his first public response to the announcement that President Uhuru Kenyatta had won re-election. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
From the start of his speech, Raila Odinga dismissed the election results that showed President Uhuru Kenyatta winning a second term with about 98% of the overall vote.
Ladies and gentlemen, the meaningless exercise, a charade purported to be an election, is now behind us. Today, we return to the hard but essential task of making elections count and democracy work in Kenya.
Odinga announced the establishment of what he called a People's Assembly, through which the opposition would exercise the solemn duty of restoring democracy, constitutionalism, and the rule of law.
So we will guard our right to dissent by exercising it. We will continue to assemble, demonstrate, to picket, and to present petitions to public authorities as often as we choose.
Voter turnout was about 39% this time, much lower than the roughly 80% in the original August election. The Supreme Court nullified Kenyatta's victory in those polls, ruling the Electoral Commission had not followed electoral law and the Constitution. Odinga called for a boycott in the rerun election, saying his demands for several members of the commission to step down, polls to be postponed beyond the 60-day deadline, and other so-called irreducible minimums had not been met. Monday, President Kenyatta said his victory was part of a process that would likely again be subjected to a test through the courts. He also said that he would submit to this constitutional path, no matter its outcomes. The International Crisis Group's Kenya analyst, Morithi Mutiga, agrees there will likely be a court challenge, which he believes will probably be mounted by civil society.
But this remains more a political than legal crisis, and the key, the cards are in the hands of the major politicians who command such support with broad sections of the public. It's true that many might have expected something more dramatic from Odinga, but we don't know what will come down the road. And of course, the People's Assembly idea at this stage has not been clearly spelled out. We need to wait and see what that will mean.
Police have been accused of using excessive force, primarily in some Nairobi slums and in the western city of Kisumu, against pro-Odinga demonstrators. The country's police service denies these allegations, saying officers have done what is necessary to protect people and property. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is making contingency plans in Nigeria to care for a possible influx of tens of thousands of Anglophone Cameroonian refugees. Unrest is growing in English-speaking parts of Cameroon amid tensions with the French-speaking majority. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency estimates 5,000 Cameroonians have fled to southeastern Nigeria, following a crackdown against protesters in the Anglophone community. But UNHCR spokesman Baba Baloch tells VOA he fears that number will swell, so preparations are underway to assist growing numbers of refugees.
UNHCR is working with the Nigerian authorities, readying assistance for at least up to 40,000 who may be forced to flee Cameroon. Colleagues think it may be a conservative estimate. There could be more people who could flee Cameroon into Nigeria.
Deadly protests erupted in Cameroon nearly 1 year ago when members of the English-speaking community began demonstrating against their marginalization by the dominant French-speaking authorities. The situation in the country has continued to worsen. Early this month, at least 8 people reportedly were shot dead by soldiers in 2 English-speaking regions. Baloch says the UNHCR and Nigerian authorities have registered about 2,000 Cameroonians who have fled to different locations in southeastern Nigeria. He says another 3,000 are waiting to be registered so they too can receive food and other assistance. He says aid workers are bracing for more arrivals, as many people might be trapped in forests on the Cameroonian side as they attempt to cross the border. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Libyan National Army, LNA, is investigating the killing of at least 36 men whose bodies were found dumped along a road near Al Abyar in eastern Libya. The men had not been shot or had been shot, and their bodies showed signs of torture. Khalifa Haftar leads the LNA and controls the eastern part of the country. He has challenged the UN-backed interim government of National Accord in Tripoli for control of Libya. Videos recently have appeared on social media that show a man resembling LNA Special Forces Major Mahmoud Warfal taking part in the extrajudicial executions of more than 30 men. The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Warfali, but the LNA says Haftar has ordered his arrest and an investigation into the filmed killings. The Presidency Council of the Government of National Accord condemned the killings of the 36 men and has ordered an investigation.
The Arab Center in Washington, D.C. recently held a conference to assess President Donald Trump's policy towards the Arab world. Several speakers and experts argued, and there are no clear policy priorities or definite objectives for the Trump administration in the region. Khalil Jansan is the executive director of the Arab Center. He explained to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi the reasons behind the assessment.
Well, unfortunately, that's part of the criticism, at least in the Arab world, this lack of clarity in terms of both objectives and in terms of agenda. And thus far, the administration has had several, definitely, several policies, several steps taken in the region or pertaining to the region. Some of them are a matter of life and death for different parts of the Arab region. Yet the impression in the Arab world by the average citizen in the Arab world, they don't feel that there is a clarity at all, that there is a sense of direction, that there is a clear objective that they can put their finger on and say, okay, this is what the United States wants to do.
In the case of Egypt, there is a mixed bag, strategic cooperation at one hand and sanctions for human rights violations. What do you make of that?
This is what I was referring to in terms of lack of clarity, and it's not unique to just Egypt, frankly. The same applies to the Gulf in many respects. The same applies to Palestine in many. So we hear a lot of statements that reflect good intentions. We want to improve relations with the Arab world. We want to support our partners in the Arab world. But when it comes to the focus specific on let's say that you mentioned human rights in your question, on the issue of human rights, it seems to have dropped on the list of priorities of this administration, at least compared with previous two or three administrations for that matter.
How do you describe the Trump administration's policy in Libya?
Confusion. Again, the U.S. for too long, and it's not, to be fair, it's not just this administration, for several administrations. They seem to have first washed their hands of the Libyan complexity, if you will. Second, they have deferred the issue to the Europeans in the sense that it's in their neighborhood. And now that the U.S. is required to kind of refocus on the Libya issue as we find some opportunities to come up with a political solution, the U.S. is having a hard time adjusting to that need.
Do you gauge a strong support from the Trump administration to the democratic transition in Tunisia?
There is a growing support, a bit more attention today than yesterday. But I wouldn't say that the attention has reached the desired level, not by the Tunisians and not by experts here, as a matter of fact, including experts within the administration who have been struggling to try to, number one, build on the progress that was made in Tunisia and come up with policies that would strengthen the regime, if you will, in Tunisia in order to secure its continuation as a regime. Particularly here I'm referring to the economic side, where a much more robust policy is needed, a much more robust economic assistance program is needed.
And that was Khalil Jassan, the executive director of the Arab Center. He explained to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi why experts say there are no clear policy priorities or definite objectives for the Trump administration in the Arab world. However, not everyone agrees. Ambassador Jawan Polashik is Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs. She explained to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi the Trump administration's policy for the Middle East and North Africa.
I think we do have clear priorities, and the top foreign policy priorities, you know, number one, defeating ISIS, defeating terrorism. Iran also is a very, very important focus for us, but I think also we can't forget, in the midst of all these urgent crises of every day, to look at those longer term trends, because we're living in the midst of really challenging times. So I think as we're focused on defeating terrorism and dealing with all these security threats, we can't lose sight of the fact that the region is undergoing such profound change, because engaging today's youth in a very constructive and productive way, ensuring that they have the tools that they need to succeed, is going to be key to ensuring everyone's long-term prosperity. And I think for the first nine months of the administration, we've been very focused on working to just decrease the levels of violence. And I like to think that we've been successful, because with these deconfliction zones, the various ceasefires, at least we're bringing down the level of suffering of the Syrian people. And it's very hard to see how there can be a credible political process when people are struggling so mightily as they have been. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we're getting in a better place now in late 2017 than we were a few years ago, because as the level of violence decreases, hopefully we can work on building that political process.
That was Ambassador Jawan Polashik, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs. She was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. With Yehia Swuhib, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. New research shows Ebola outbreaks are more likely to occur about 2 years after forests are cut down in West and Central Africa. While scientists have known the link between deforestation and Ebola for years, this is the first study that gives a timeline to outbreaks. Researchers think cutting down forests increases contact between people and animals that carry the virus, such as bats. An international team of scientists published their results yesterday on Nature.com. They say knowing the timeline between cutting trees and outbreaks gives governments time to set up monitoring systems and medical facilities to respond to infections. Ebola can be swiftly lethal if not treated. In the worst recorded outbreak, more than 11,000 people died of Ebola in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone between March of 2014 and early 2016. Vaccines are still under development.
As South Africa's governing African National Congress prepares to elect new leaders in December, the party is being hit by one blow after another. Recently, the Supreme Court of Appeal upheld a high court ruling that President Jacob Zuma should face corruption charges. But it doesn't mean Mr. Zuma will end up in court anytime soon. Nadia Same in Johannesburg has the story.
South African President Jacob Zuma has until November 30th to explain to the National Prosecuting Authority why he should not face corruption charges. The charges were first dropped back in 2009. Since then, multiple courts have found that decision was irrational, and the president does in fact have a case to answer to. Recently, Zuma, along with the National Prosecuting Authority, appealed a 2016 High Court ruling to that effect. They argued it simply wouldn't be appropriate to put a serving president on trial. But the Supreme Court of Appeal disagrees, making it clear in its ruling that Zuma should face these charges, which relate to 783 suspicious payments made to his account. James Salf is a member of the Opposition Democratic Alliance.
Our understanding of the court judgment is very simply that the charges of fraud, corruption, money laundering and racketeering are now reinstated against President Jacob Zuma after having been unlawfully dropped nearly 10 years ago.
The Democratic Alliance wants the National Prosecuting Authority to set a court date for Zuma, but the NPA is headed by Sean Abrams, a man seen to be sympathetic to the president. Critics say he's unlikely or unwilling to act in the face of mounting evidence of state capture by the president's friends, the controversial Gupta family. The opposition estimates the legal battle to get charges reinstated against Zuma has cost in the region of $2.2 million. It wants the president held personally liable for that amount. Political analyst Lukhona Mnguni says there's legal precedence for the reinstatement of old charges. He cites a Supreme Court matter involving former intelligence boss Richard Ndluli.
And in that case, the court ruled that if the decision to withdraw charges is successfully reviewed, then that should automatically activate the charges on the roll. Of course, we've seen a bit of communication from the Office of the National Director of Public Prosecutions stating that, you know, he's in communication with the Hawks, which is the Special Crimes Unit, and he's trying to ascertain whether the witnesses are still there, the docket is still there, and all other documentation is still intact for the case to proceed.
The SA presidency says while it's disappointed by the Supreme Court of Appeal ruling, it's not surprised. President Zuma's legal team has indicated it wants an opportunity to make its case before the court. It's also highlighting a lifestyle report by auditing firm KPMG on Zuma. That document is at the heart of the original fraud charges. Johan van der Walt, the man who conducted the audit, is being investigated by an industry regulator over a questionable report on the South African Revenue Service's intelligence unit. KPMG was forced to retract that report, and the presidency argues this throws the auditor's credibility into question. Charges against President Zuma stem from his relationship with his former financial advisor Shabir Sheikh, who was convicted of corruption and, in the judge's words, had a corrupt relationship with Zuma. The financial advisor was sentenced to 15 years. He now says he's willing to be a witness for the state should Zuma go on trial.
His evidence in respect of the nature of the corruption and the extent of the corruption will clearly be critical. On the other hand, Mr. Sheikh is himself a convicted felon, and I think a court may very well take his word with a little bit of circumspection, bearing in mind that he has a score to settle at this stage with President Zuma.
The ANC spokesperson admits the court ruling has a negative impact on the party. For now, all eyes are on the National Prosecuting Authority to see whether it will haul President Zuma back to court for yet another round of this long-standing battle. For VOA Africa, I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
At China's Communist Party Congress this month, a meeting of the country's autocratic government held every 5 years President Xi Jinping said the country would be a contributor to global development, key to what is the so-called One Belt, One Road initiative, which seeks to rekindle ancient trade routes linking China with Europe and Africa. Billions of dollars have been plowed into infrastructure projects along the route, but as Henry Ridgewell reports, there are calls for China to focus on development goals, such as alleviating poverty.
Running 1,300 kilometers over the world's highest mountain pass, the so-called Friendship or Karakoram Highway is evidence of China's willingness to spend big. Costing tens of billions of dollars, the road links Western China with Pakistan, part of Beijing's One Belt, One Road initiative, a central tenet of President Xi's leadership, says Professor Steve Tsang of London's School of Oriental and African Studies.
The government is committed to do whatever it can to make sure that it is successful. So a lot more money and resources will be put into it to support that.
But figures show since the Karakoram Highway was built, Pakistani exports to China have actually fallen, while imports have increased, raising concern China's new Silk Road could become a one-way street. Stephen Gelb of the Overseas Development Institute says Beijing should focus its investments on global development goals.
At the moment, there's a lot of focus on infrastructure and particularly transport, pipelines, that sort of thing, which don't directly address poverty. And in fact, there's been in some cases some controversy about the social and environmental impacts. But I think the aim should be to address development, including poverty and related issues.
Think about it.
Gliding above the choking road traffic of the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, the Chinese-funded tramway system opened last year at a cost of $500 million. Beijing says investments like this will boost African economies, thereby alleviating poverty. Gelb says it is also part of China's plan to become a dominant force on the global stage.
That was affirmed in Xi Jinping's speech. China's very much about these days rules-based global governance, multilateralism, globalization.
Visiting India this week, US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson accused China of not always playing by those rules.
China, while rising alongside India, has done so less responsibly, at times undermining the international rules-based order.
Recipient countries have welcomed Chinese investment, which sometimes comes with fewer conditions than Western aid, such as demands for democratic reform. But Professor Steve Tsang warns there could be a sting in the tail.
The real issue will come when some of those countries, particularly in Central Asia, have to pay back some of the loans that were accrued in the Belt and Road Initiative, and most of those countries will have problems paying back those loans.
For now, Chinese investment continues to expand. Development campaigners say Beijing's focus should be not only on ports and pipelines, but on tackling poverty. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.